If you don't know me, I'm Ryan Lenners, a team pastor here at the church. And today we're going to be kicking off the message. I have to give you guys a pretest of the topic we're going to talk about. There's some facts that even I had no idea about today's topic. And so we have to educate ourselves about a few things before we get going. So we're going to take a quiz today. Okay, so the first question in this quiz is, Roman soldiers were sometimes paid with this common meal ingredient. Is this olive oil, wine, salt, or yeast? Salt. Did you know that before Brent said the topic was salt and light? No. So, fun fact, the Latin word for salt is sal, which is how we get our word salary today that we use. And that's why when somebody says, yeah, he's not worth his salt, they're saying you're not worth your paycheck. So that's where all of that comes from. Now you know the topic of the rest of the quiz. Who feels like they're a salt expert? Anybody? A few of you? No? No? Okay. Next one. Which of these contains the most salt? These are all from McDonald's nutrition facts. The Big Mac, the large French fry, or the 6 chicken nuggets? B? I got fries? It is the Big Mac. It is more than double as much sodium as either of those other two items. Whoa, stay away from the Big Mac. All right, it's a special sauce, I'm sure. Okay, in the 1920s, salt became the primary tool to fight off this disease. Goiter, scurvy, polio, or hookworm? We've got some goiters. He's got his tablet out. Did you Google that? Okay, whew, just making sure somebody's competitive here. Yes, it is goiter. So iodized, salt with the little girl with the umbrella, the iodized salt, like that was the norm. Nowadays, only 50% of the salt in America has the iodized salt anymore. We might all get goiter if we don't go back to that. So that was the key to it. Okay. What is the primary use of salt in America today? As an ingredient in our food, as fertilizer in our fields, or as ice melt on our roads? I've got a C, a few.
A.
A? Yeah, okay. And the answer is ice melt on our roads. Accounts for almost half of all salt used. Salt we actually consume is only 3% of salt use in America. Yeah. I love this next question. Oh, no. Sorry, I'm skipping one. In the Bible, who literally became the salt of the earth? We've got Noah's son, Lot's wife, King Ahaz, or Elisha? Lot's wife. All right, we've got those. The Bible scholars in the room say Lot's wife became a pillar of salt. Next question Pastor Amy gave to me. What does it mean if someone is salty? All right, does it mean A, they're spunky and bubbly, B, they're angry or hostile, or C, they are advanced in age? B, angry and hostile. Ironically, that answer is the only one that has nothing to do with salt and its uses. The other two I made up based off of how salt actually is used. We'll get into that. So, final question. How many books of the Bible mention salt? How many books of the Bible, if you do a search of your Bible, have the word salt in, if it's in there once, it counted? B? All right, you're all over the map. It is D. 22 of the 66 books of the Bible, a full third of the Bible, mentions the word salt. I was floored by this. So I had to, of course, look through all the verses, and we're going to run together right now through a quick summary of how salt is used in the Bible, and most of these will be new to you, and you'll be like, really? Salt. Lot's wife became a pillar of salt in Genesis. When Sodom and Gomorrah, God was going to destroy them. He said, don't look back. She looked back. You got to listen to God. She turned into a pillar of salt. We see that there's a salty sacrifice. God wanted salt added to one of the sacrifices that was described in the book of Exodus. There is a covenant of salt. When God makes a covenant with David and with the Davidic line of kings, it's referred to as a covenant of salt because salt is a preservative that makes things last forever. So it's the eternal covenant with King David. The Israelites scattered salt to destroy the land. After they would defeat a town in Joshua, they salted the field so that they became a wasteland. Salt was added to water that was unclean to make it taste fresh in a miracle. We see one city referred to as a city of salt. We see a valley of salt described, a wasteland of salt. They're all different places. We see salt is used in tasty food, and in Job's life, when life is going really bad, he complains that he can't even taste the salt in the food and it all tastes bland. There's a weird thing in Ezekiel that says that Israel is like a baby that is not even washed after birth or rubbed in salt or wrapped in a cloth. So somehow they use salt with newborns in Israel at that time. Raise your hand if you knew that. Anybody remember that verse? No, I was surprised. And then finally we get to the Gospels and Jesus says, "You are salt." And so salt is obviously very, very common through the life of the Israelites, and in this pre-modern world, salt was everywhere. It was used as payment for the Roman soldiers, like we already talked about. But today where we're going to land is that you are salt. They all knew what salt meant. What does it mean when we read that we are to be the salt of the earth? And this is where we're going now in the Sermon on the Mount. We started this last week with the Beatitudes. In the Beatitudes, we talked about how ultimately they're an invitation that everybody is invited, even the losers, essentially, the poor in spirit, can come and be a part of the kingdom. And then it starts to describe what kingdom life looks like. And it ends with, but if you live this life, if you're a part of the kingdom, expect to be persecuted. And I know a lot of people hearing that would be like, well, Jesus, I don't know if I really want to experience the persecution that society's going to put on me. Is there a way out of it? And that's when Jesus goes to this next passage and basically says, no, that's not my plan for you. And so right after we come out of the Beatitudes, we read this next passage from Matthew chapter 5, verse 13 through 16. And I'd like to read that to you right now. It says, "You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on a stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." So that's our passage that we are going to dig into today. And you see, it clearly has two illustrations. I focused on the front half. This first illustration is this analogy with salt, where Jesus says, "You are the salt of the earth." And when we think of what are the uses of salt, what might he be trying to teach us in saying that? And the first use that I think probably comes to mind for most of us, because we have it on our kitchen tables, is that it's used as a seasoning on our food. Like when food tastes bland, you add salt and then it tastes good. How many of you know somebody who adds salt to absolutely everything and more salt than they ever should? Yeah, we've got some hands up. I was raised, we had one spice in the spice rack. We didn't have a spice rack, we had a spice bottle. And it was Lowry's seasoning salt. It went on everything. And so we have to understand, in Jesus' day, they had very easy access to salt. It was very common. They had the Dead Sea right there, which was incredibly salty. They could just evaporate out the water and have access to salt there. They also had a very pure salt mine nearby. So they had access to this salt. It was used widely. And I think if we say, okay, Jesus is referring to salt as how we use it on food, then his message when he says, "You are the salt of the earth," I think what he's saying is, you bring flavor to society. You take what could be bland and you make it better. You infuse it with life. As a follower of Jesus, you aren't supposed to just maintain the status quo, but you should bring something better to the world all around. But another thing Jesus might have been referring to here, another use of salt, is its preserving quality. We forget that they didn't have refrigeration back in Jesus' day. So you couldn't go catch a fish on Saturday and be like, I've got dinner for Thursday. By the time you get to Thursday, that fish would not have been very edible. It'd be disgusting unless you preserved it and packed it in salt. And we maybe, raise your hand if you've heard of things being packed in salt to preserve, some of you. I was talking to my country neighbor. Odie is 80 years old and he's lived on that same parcel of land for 60 years. He was telling me as a boy, when they would slaughter the pig in the fall, they would put the pig in a box full of salt and pack the salt inside the inside of it. They had no refrigerators when he was a child. And when it was time for dinner and they wanted pork chops, mom would open up the box, pull the salt back, chop up whatever part of the pig they wanted to eat, cover it back up in the salt, and put the lid on. And that pig stayed in a box of salt with no refrigeration from fall all the way until late spring. So like 6 months, meat is edible with no refrigeration. We forget about that because we're Americans. We all have refrigerators in our homes. And I said, just curious, because I knew what I was teaching. So Otis, after the meat was all gone and it was spring, what would you do with the salt? And he says, without being prodded at all, oh, that was worthless. You couldn't use it again. You'd just throw it away. And I'm like, that's exactly what Jesus said. Once it loses its saltiness, it's good for nothing to be thrown out on the streets and trampled under feet. He's like, there's a point. You can't keep using it forever. And it loses its saltiness and you throw it out. Jesus' message, if we're looking, and this is the point that Jesus is trying to make, that salt was a preservative and people understood that, then you preserve society. You prevent rot and decay. That kingdom-minded people are, yes, the world is evil, but if kingdom-minded people are in all corners of society, we're trying to prevent evil from running amok, and we're trying to keep society going forward. Keep people doing good and showing love and uplifting a society that is more or less loaded with sin and evil and often people who are trying to fight for power. But it's our job to push against that, to preserve the society and prevent the rot and decay. Another way that Jesus might have meant this is putting salt in fields as fertilizer. I didn't believe this when I read it. I'm like, the only story I'd heard about salt was kind of like the Israelites destroying fields. My brother-in-law in high school played a practical joke on another high school. They dragged bags of salt to create an image on the opposing high school field's football team that burned into the grass for an entire growing season, the image. He was suspended for a long time. But... So I'm like, salt can be used as fertilizer? Go to Google sometime, look up organic fertilizer, and you will find bags of sea salt for sale at a very expensive price with up to 90 trace minerals in it. If you use sea salt with these trace minerals, it's an organic fertilizer people use all over the world. Found that out. Well, what if Jesus is referring to this aspect of salt? They had the Dead Sea salt. Then it's saying that you enrich society, that you help it to flourish more abundantly, that you bring growth and vigor to society. And so what's interesting is we look at this passage, you are the salt of the earth, and it's a little more complicated because we say, well, which of these three did Jesus actually mean? And we can't know for certain what he meant. And quite possibly he might have meant it in all these ways. People were familiar. Salt is very common. It was used in all these ways. And just saying you are the salt of the earth, there it brings this understanding that you can season the world around you, preserve the world around you, enrich the world around you. You make a difference in society. And on the backside of this analogy with salt, he does say, though, if salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? And I believe Jesus was asking a rhetorical question here because he knows salt can't lose its saltiness if it's just sitting in a box. And at the same time, though, it can't be reused or made salty again after it is used. I think the point here, what he's getting at is, ultimately, if salt isn't salty, then it can't do its job. It is worthless. You understand? If salt isn't salty, it doesn't add any flavor to the meal that you add it to. It doesn't preserve. If it's mixed with other things, and so it's not actually salty, it doesn't preserve. It doesn't work as a fertilizer. It's just worthless. And I think the point here he's trying to make is, look, if you're a follower of me, if you're in my kingdom, but you're not actually being the salt to the community around you, you're not being of much value to the kingdom. Like, as a Christian, you should be salt impacting the world, preserving and enriching and flavoring society. And if you're not doing any of those things, you're kind of like salt that's lost its saltiness. As Otis would say, throw it out. It's not good for anything. And then in this passage, it moves on to the light analogy. And I'm not going to talk about this for a long time. It says, you are the light of the world. A town set on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. We've talked about it before. Pastor Brent gave this message in for Christmas, talking about Jesus as the light. We understand, ultimately, that light illuminates. It lights things up. It makes it so that you can see clearly. You're able to avoid traps. You're able to move forward, move freely without worrying about bumping into things. And ultimately, light is an analogy for wisdom and having the ability to see clearly the world around you. Jesus gives us the light that we see the supernatural and what's going on in this world supernaturally more clearly. And it makes a difference for us. And so I believe when Jesus is saying, you are the light of the world, he's saying, you illuminate society, and you now can help others see more clearly. And again, if you're the light of the world, everybody can see the town on the hill, and you're not a light that would be in a house and be put under a bowl. That would make no sense. So by being a light, you should not be covered. You should be making a difference, and you should be illuminating society around to help people see clearly what's going on in this world, to see clearly their need for forgiveness through Jesus, God's love for them and acceptance for them. So this passage and these analogies are really an answer to a question that Christians have asked for a long time, and that's, how am I supposed to engage in this world? Different Christians through different times have seen their role with culture very differently. And I think two of these main ways people engage with culture are wrong, and the third one is more tied to this being salt and light in our community. And so the first way that many Christians have seen their role with culture is to hide from culture. I think the earliest that we see this, like, very clearly, I read about this when I took a class in church history. In the 5th century, there was a guy named Simeon the Elder. And he was the first stylite, which is a fancy word for pillar hermit, which meant he believed that he needed to remove himself from culture so much that it couldn't impact or influence him or corrode his character in any way. So he stepped away from culture, he went into the wilderness, and he built a pillar 50 feet tall. And at the top of it, it had a platform 3 feet by 3 feet, so about how much I move when I'm talking to you. And he lived there for 37 years. Don't worry, he had a ladder so people could bring him meals once a day, but he lived on a pillar. It wasn't good enough to go into the wilderness. He then had to remove himself, go up 50 feet so nobody could share his space, so that he was separate from the world. And people looked at that and were like, this is amazing. This is how you live a holy and righteous and pure life. And he actually created a movement that became the ascetics. And there were many monks or guys that left and went to the wilderness and lived on poles for the next 100 years. Crazy movement. A more modern example of this are the Amish and the Mennonites today. They live in kind of cloistered communities. Some of them still ride horse and buggies because they believe culture corrodes and corrupts, and they don't want that in their lives. And so they kind of close off the way, they circle the wagons, they live a closed off life. If you grow up as a child and you decide you don't want to follow that way of life, they're kind of like, okay, you can't live amongst us then. We have our own tiny culture here, but we do not impact culture in any way. We're a bubble. And most of us understand as Christians, like, that's not how we live. But there are a lot of Christians who do live a way where they hide from culture. It's very easy to live in a Christian bubble where all your friends are church friends. And the TV that you watch is all the Christian TV channels. You listen to the Christian radio. You avoid the news. And you essentially cut yourself off from making any impact on those who don't already know Jesus. And some people would say, but I'm just trying to follow Jesus the best way that I know how. And I'd say, I commend you for wanting to live a holy and righteous life. We're supposed to do that. And how are you being salt and light to the world around you if you're living in that bubble world? So we have to think about that. Is that the right way? I do not think that that is how Jesus wanted us to be mixing with society, or to not be mixing with society when he tells us to be salt and light. The next way that people look at their interaction between Christianity and culture is that we are to fight against the culture. It's our job to bring America back to its Christian roots. We are to be cultural warriors. And people, when they fight against culture, often they rightly see the decay that's going on in the world around. Morals that are lapsing, the world going to a more selfish place. They identify that the right way. But then they decide it's up to me to force onto other people that they need and demand that they bring this world, this country to a better place rather than influencing and trying to lead them to that better place. It's like parenting. You can tell your child this is exactly what you have to do and do it because I told you, or you can say, hey, wouldn't it be great if you helped tidy up your room and maybe I'll help. There's two different ways to get the job done. When we try to fight against and push and demand, sometimes it doesn't work out so great. The earliest examples we have of people fighting against culture was one of Jesus' 12 disciples, Simon the Zealot. The Zealots in Jesus' day were people who hated the Roman rule, and they saw it was their job to, they wanted to raise a rebellion against the Romans and push them out of Jerusalem, push them out of Israel and the area around so that they could once again create this godly nation and bring back Israel to what it was supposed to be. And so that was, you know, clearly a way of saying, I want to fight to get ultimately a righteous, holy nation. But we see Jesus wasn't that way at all. You know, when they came to arrest him, they said, put your swords away. He wasn't about fighting to bring about what he wanted, yet he had incredible influence on the world around him. In modern day, we see Joseph Kony, the leader of the Lord's Resistance Army. It sounds super spiritual. He's in Uganda, murdering lots of people, kidnapping others, trying to bring about a new nation that is based on the Ten Commandments. And he's getting it all wrong. In his mind, we need to get to a Ten Commandment-based society, but he's trying to force it onto the people. And it's been creating war there for many, many years. Today, we all know, we still have culture warriors in America that are fighting to take this nation and force this nation to a certain place. And unfortunately, I think that demanding that people go a certain way and live a certain way against their own secular values tends to push people who don't know Jesus and don't love Jesus further and further away. The third and final way that we, I believe, we look at and say this is how culture and Christians can interact is what Salt and Light is most talking about, and that is to influence culture. It's all through history, we see Christians preserving culture and helping to culture and the world society to flourish. The first public schools were all based on Christians trying to educate. The hospitals here in America were all based on Christians taking care of the poor and those who needed care. Let's just think, before they rebranded all the hospitals in Des Moines, we had Methodist and Lutheran and Mercy. If those don't sound like Christian hospitals to me, right? Like, Christianity has made an incredible impact, an influence on our culture. They led the way in abolishing slavery. Nowadays, we see Christians are fighting against human trafficking around the world. Christians in all sorts of ways, and many churches like our own, we're trying to make a positive impact on the world around us. That's why we're doing the Ashworth Learning Center and the food trucks in Ashworth Snow. It's to bring life to bring seasoning to our community and also to, along the way, be able to tell them about Jesus, to bring light, to help preserve life for them. That's what we're trying to do. For us, though, some people look at, okay, if I'm supposed to influence culture, you can get to the place where the seminary I went to, Bethel University, they have core values. One of their core values is to be a world changer. And I love this concept that they're trying to teach all these young people that life isn't all about you, it's about the impact you can make. However, I have a bit of an issue with the phrase world changer, because then it says you need to be making a grand impact on the world around. And it's easy by the time you get into your mid-30s or 40s like me, I don't know if I've changed the world. But I think what we're called to do, if we're salt and light, is not to make that one thing that you get your own Wikipedia page, because everybody's like, wow, look what you did. But no, it's to impact the world around you one person at a time, one day at a time. Just being there, constantly making that little impact day after day, encounter after encounter. That's what it means to be salt and light in this world. So when that angry driver gets mad at me because I had to merge into his lane because of all that stupid construction down Ashworth for Google Fiber, and he gives me the bird and he's honking, I just waved and gave him a thumbs up and a big smile. Like, hey, you know what? This world's got plenty of anger. Like, dude, I can't do anything. My lane ended. I'm sorry. People get so angry. This world doesn't need more anger, right? This world needs people who are able to be peacemakers, though I don't know if I made him feel any happier. But I didn't escalate within myself. And ultimately, to change our culture, not one of us is going to do it on our own. One singular grain of salt cannot preserve an entire piece of meat. That piece of meat is preserved when it is filled with millions of grains of salt wrapped all around it. And that's what our society needs today. It needs all of Christ's followers to say, I understand what it means to be salt. I understand what it means to be light. And when we all live that way, we can impact, we can preserve, we can enrich, we can help our community flourish all around us. And why do we do this? This verse ends with the ultimate why, because what we know is it's not easy to do this. It's not easy to be salt and light. People don't always appreciate it. Even though we're trying to bring something good to the world, they don't always appreciate it. Sometimes it's hard. Sometimes it comes with a cost. But we do it from this last verse is because it tells us at the end of the passage that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. We live this countercultural way of life for God's glory. We don't do it for ourselves so that I feel good because I'm a good person. We don't ultimately really even do it for our community. We do it for God because that's what God desires for the world that he created. That's how he shows his love to the world, is by putting followers, us, all through these communities, being his love, the hands-on, tangible acts of love and kindness that this world so desperately needs. One final interesting thing about this passage, when it says salt of the earth, earth is talking about the ground that we walk on. When it says light of the world, it's light of the cosmos is the Greek word there. So we are literally the salt of what we walk on and the light of everything above. We are to influence everything in every sphere that we encounter. And we have that opportunity to bring to people one of the most useful things they need, salt that's so useful in so many ways of life, light that we can't grow, we can't do anything if we don't have light. People don't understand how badly they need Christians in the world, actually living the way Christians need to live, as influencers and not as culture warriors, not as Christians just hiding in little cloistered communities. But they do need us. They need our joy and our peace and our patience, the wisdom that comes from knowing God's word. They need to hear the truth that Jesus forgives and offers them peace, that they can be children of God and become part of his family. And you are in a unique position to offer that to others by how you live and how you treat them and the good news that you share with them. But that can only happen if you are willing to engage with the culture around you. If you hide away, try to protect yourself, you're not going to make any difference. Then you are worthless to the cause of what Jesus is trying to do around this world. And if you try to impact culture by fighting with it, like I've said, it drives people further away. This world needs people who are willing to lovingly engage the culture all around to preserve it, to enrich it, and to bring seasoning to this life. Would you bow your heads with me as we pray?